On this episode of the China Unscripted podcast, ride in style in a Karl Marx hot air balloon, how the Chinese Communist Party has learned important lessons from East Germany. And our guest today is Jonathan Colton, whose China-related song was censored by CBS for being too controversial. Welcome to the China Unscripted podcast. I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley John.
And I'm Matt Gnezda.
And I can hear your cheers of joy that Shelley is back with us.
Woohoo!
Well, I don't know. I don't know if I can... People seem to really enjoy the last podcast without me.
People, no. The podcast was very good without you. Our interview with Josh Phillips about the history and origins of communism. But a lot of people were like, hey, have Josh back on and have Shelley there to be part of it.
I can't wait.
It was good, and one thing I really liked about that is at the end we said, you know, please leave comments, even if you're not the type of person to leave comments. And people did leave comments for the first time ever, and it was fantastic to really have so much interaction with you guys. And
so are you saying we should ask again people to leave comments, even if they don't leave comments, but then at a certain point people aren't going to listen anymore?
It'll stop being special.
That's true. I mean, it is nice to have comments, though. Because
it's always nice.
It's always nice to know what you guys as listeners think about the topics that we cover.
And it's true that you can't really leave comments on iTunes or really anything except the YouTube
channel. But and most of our listeners are actually on our website, chinaunscripted.com. But that's also fine, because the advantage of that, of course, is that we make a little bit of money from the advertising.
Wait, we make money from this?
Remember that check for $20.14 we got last month?
Wow.
After a year of making this, could we get a Domino's pizza? This China Unscripted brought to you by Domino's.
No, it's not, unfortunately. Actually, no. That's probably good, because remember the last time we had Domino's in Sydney when we were preparing for that panel?
Already going off topic.
I like Domino's. What can I say? The topic of this episode.
Because you like Domino's because we want to leave that sponsorship opportunity open, is what you're saying?
Yes. I genuinely do like Domino's. Do I think Domino's is better than Pizza Hut? That will be determined by sponsorship. So stay tuned.
I actually like the New York Dollar Pizza. I don't think they're going to be a sponsor, though.
So yes, as Shelley said, we got off topic. And the topic today is Shelley. Hi, Shelley.
Hi.
So, you were gone, and Matt and I were very sad, scared. We didn't know what to do with ourselves.
I was still remotely editing scripts, so I don't know that I was gone for that long.
So one of the places that you were was Berlin.
Yes. This is the segue where we start talking about the Stasi Museum?
Yes.
Okay. So I went to the Stasi Museum.
And Shelley, what are the Stasi for people who may not have heard of them?
First of all, if you haven't heard of the Stasi, you haven't truly lived. And they are the East German secret police.
That sounds like a good job.
State security. I mean, it's had a lot of security, I guess, job security. They had about 90,000 employees.
And that was something that came out after the Berlin Wall fell.
That
like
how
people
many
didn't
employees
know
that they had?
Well, how widespread it was.
Well, that's true. One of the things that they had in the Stasi Museum, the Stasi Museum is kind of on the outskirts of Berlin, and it is in a complex that actually used to be the Stasi headquarters. So, you know, you can go and get that authentic Soviet bloc kind of architecture.
Ooh.
That warm, like,
the
communist,
warm concrete.
You know, like Eastern European feel. So it is actually in the building that was their headquarters. It's a complex of buildings, but it's not a very fun museum in a certain way. Like, there was no gift shop.
I
think that's...
They're missing their bet.
I know. It's the first museum I've actually gone to where there hasn't been some kind of merchandising.
And that includes the mausoleum that holds Mao Zedong's disintegrating body in Tiananmen Square. Once you go through that, there's a gift shop where you can buy like Mao Zedong dishes and watches and all this stuff.
I've never been to that mausoleum. So
mausoleum.
Yeah.
I just came up with that.
I just thought that too.
But you didn't say it.
No, you said it, Chris.
You get credit, Chris.
Thank you.
So the Stasi Museum didn't even have that.
No. But I think it's because they're seriously researching and kind of revealing what the really invasive secret police are doing in the GDR, so the German Democratic Republic, which was East Germany.
I like how a lot of authoritarian regimes, they use democratic in their name because that makes it like Democratic Republic of Congo.
The Democratic People's Republic of Korea?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's North Korea, just in case anyone was confused.
Yeah, I mean, if you say democratic, it must be.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think back. I don't remember there being a gift shop in the Museum of Tolerance, for example.
What's the Museum of Tolerance?
It's a Holocaust museum.
Yeah. The one in LA, right?
Yeah.
I haven't been there in a long time, but it's, yeah.
It was a great school field trip.
Oh.
There were certain parts of the museum they didn't let us go into.
How old of a grade school field trip?
Like fourth grade, so maybe like 8, 9, 10 years old.
Okay. Okay. I mean, it's not like kindergarten field trip. Yeah.
Ooh.
I did also go to the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin, which is a square. It's in a square, and then you walk in, and it looks like a bunch of uneven cement blocks. And there may be, in the beginning, it looks like there may be like knee high or something like that. And you start walking in, and then suddenly you're in the middle of these like tall cement rectangular blocks. Like, it's almost like it happened without you noticing it.
It's like gradual descent?
Yes. And like the blocks are getting taller as the ground is like kind of like sloping up and down, but it's not that obvious from standing at the edge that that's what's about to happen. So you walk in and like suddenly like you're surrounded by these kind of like ominous rectangular blocks. It's very effective. And yeah, anyway, but back to the Stasi Museum. I think it's because they are actually, they're researching and doing work on what the Stasi did, and they have the archives. It's not in that building, but there's a separate building in Berlin where you, as a former East German citizen, can go and look up your file. You can see if you have a file that the Stasi kept on you.
It's like if you go to the principal's office and get a look at the file they have on you, right?
Yeah, but it's more of a double-edged sword, I think, with the Stasi file.
Well, yes. I think the question is, do you want to know, maybe? Yeah.
Well, because do you want to know which of your neighbors, who you may now be friends with, was actually spying on you for the Stasi?
I took this guided tour of the Stasi Museum, and if you go to the Stasi Museum, I highly recommend it. At 3 o'clock on Thursdays through Mondays, I think, they have a English language free tour. One of the things that our tour guide said was that this is like one of the big remaining traumas of people who lived through the GDR, is that you don't know who was watching you. And sometimes it could be your family members. It could be your best friends. There was an exhibit in the Stasi Museum that showed what they called IMs, which were their informants. So I said the Stasi had about 90,000 employees. They had 189,000 informants.
Whoa.
So these are not full-time informants. These are just people who would give information to the Stasi. So you don't know, like there are photos of this guy with his friends who were getting married and he was informing on both of them. There was a woman who was in like a pretty well-known punk rock band and she was a Stasi informant.
Whoa.
So all of the stuff. I think one of the, and then it showed things like there was a famous case where Willy Brandt, who was a German chancellor in the 70s, it turned out that one of his staff members, Günter Guillaume, was a member of the Stasi. He was a spy, not an informant, but that he was secretly spying on Brandt for years, and then it came out at the time and became what basically took Brandt's government down, which was in some ways ironic because he was actually one of the first leaders to want to like reestablish relations with the GDR from the West Germany side. But it turned out that there was a one of his, you know, advisors was a spy.
That's crazy. I think what's interesting about this is though, like, there's not a lot of museums dedicated to exposing the things that happened under communism. And that makes this, I think, somewhat special.
There are several of these museums in Berlin. If you are interested, there's the Stasi Museum, there's the DDR Museum, which is...
Because when I think DDR, I think Dance Revolution!
It is not that fun. It is... DDR is, in German, is GDR, right? So it's the German name for the GDR,
Way less fun, but that's fun.
Yeah, so it's an interactive museum where you go and you can see, like, they have, like, an exhibit that's a replica of what a standard apartment would have been in East Berlin at the time. And so you can go and, like, open the drawers and see what people had in their homes and, you know...
So you can basically search it without a warrant.
Uh-huh. Just like the Stasi. Actually, there was... Okay, first I want to talk about the weird thing at the DDR Museum, which is in the apartment, the windows, they had a simulation of the outside. And there was a giant hot air balloon with Karl Marx's head. It was a hot air balloon in the shape of Karl Marx's head that would just...
Wait. So it wasn't like a hot air balloon with a graphic of
Marx's
head.
No. It was in the shape of Karl Marx's head.
How'd they get the beard?
It seems inefficient aerodynamically, but go on.
It's a computer illustration.
I know, but computers still have to follow rules, but go on.
Okay. But this Karl Marx balloon...
You've clearly never seen The Matrix, Matt.
Just because you were in The Matrix doesn't mean...
Guys.
I'm sorry. Shelley, don't interrupt us. Matt and I are talking.
I just can't believe you'd rather argue about The Matrix than hear about the Karl Marx head.
No, I really want to hear about this. And yet there is no gift shop. I mean,
No. There was a gift shop for the DDR Museum. This is the more fun. If you want to go to a more fun East German museum, this is the DDR Museum.
So let's talk about the more fun one with
this
Karl
episode of
head.
China Unscripted is brought to you by the Germany Tourism Board. Tour Berlin.
See all the depressing stuff that they did to each other.
So, Karl Marx.
So there was just this...
I mean, he always was full of hot air.
Oh! Wow, I think that... Ow.
What I should have done is... Badoonch. Instead of actually hitting the table.
Matt hit the table, yeah, doing the drum sound. So if there was a horrible loud sound and you are now deaf, we have no money, so please don't sue us. It won't do you any good.
So
if you went deaf.
So Karl Marx's face on a balloon.
No. The head, the balloon was the shape of Karl Marx's head. I will post this on Twitter so you can see what I'm talking about. And because I stood there amazed, and then I waited for an entire like section so it could come back so I could take a photo of it. It was because it was like you're looking outside the window, and the window has little cars and like trees. It was as if you were looking out of the window of the apartment.
Okay.
And for some reason, out the window of this apartment, you could see this Karl Marx head hot air balloon slowly coming towards you.
Was that something they actually had then?
Passing overhead? No.
So that was a lie. A museum
I guess
lie.
It's a museum lie. But yeah, so the DDR Museum was the more fun museum.
Now I'm just imagining if like the U.S. had something like that, and someday you see like a giant hot air balloon in the shape of President Trump's head floating through the sky. That'd be so scary.
I mean, I feel like we saw that in that Italian parade float that we had on that episode of China.
Oh my gosh, that creeped me out so
that
much.
Was scary.
Yeah, that was pretty. Yeah. What were you talking about before the head, because now I can't
remember.
Oh,
the Matrix. So, no, Matt, the Matrix. Let me.
We were talking about how in the DDR museum, you could see what a typical East German apartment looked like. And you could go through the drawers and search it.
Oh, Stasi search warrants. This is what I was going to say. So they actually had a section in the Stasi museum that showed you how, when they came to search your apartment, what they would do before they started was to take Polaroids of what everything looked like, so then they could secretly search your apartment and then put everything back exactly the way it was, so you would never know that they had been in there.
So even back then, a Western company was helping.
I don't know. It might have not been Polaroid. I mean, East Germany had their own version of Coca-Cola.
Really?
Yes.
Is it still made?
I don't think so.
The People's Cola.
I forget what it's called, but they definitely, because they also had their own blue jeans brand that was supposed to be, because people would kind of smuggle Levi's through, especially in the 80s when things were starting to loosen up a bit. People were like, really wanted these like Western, European and American things like Levi's. They listened to Bruce Springsteen, all this stuff. And so they came up with their own brand of jeans that was supposed to be cooler than Levi's, you know.
Did it work?
I get the sense no, but, you know, does the state-sponsored version of, I mean, I think they had a little bit better branding, though, than the Chinese Communist Party. One of the things I noticed in the DDR Museum and the Stasi Museum was that it all seemed pretty familiar in that Leninist way, that Marxist-Leninist way. One of the exhibits in the museum had basically they would show you what the law said, what the Constitution said, and then when you flipped it over, it showed you what the party actually did, which was exactly the opposite of what the law said. And I was like, well, that looks familiar. Or they had the Young Pioneers in the GDR, except they wore blue scarves.
Ooh.
Instead of red.
Interesting character development.
Yes. But then after you got too old for the Young Pioneers, you would join what was called the German Free Youth, I think, something like that. And that just sounds way more fun than joining the Communist Youth League, right? If you
German Free Youth, yeah.
Yeah, so that sounds more hip and with it. So,
and sounds so free.
Yeah, so free. Actually, one of the interesting things I learned, and I think this is one reason why the Chinese Communist Party is doing such a huge crackdown on religion and spiritual beliefs, was that the church in the GDR was one of the major kind of resistance movements against the party. It was the Lutheran Church. So the church was, a lot of people would go to church groups, like youth would go to church groups and kind of organize and like pass around things that were censored and things like that. So
that's why, you know, in a successful communist state, you cannot have religion be out of control of the party.
You can't have ideological competition, basically, yeah. Right? But yeah, I mean, the Stasi Museum was great. They showed you that, you know, people would know that there were about 15 or 20 Stasi offices that everybody knew was there. And then there was a map that showed you those 15 or 20 offices. And then in a different color were all the offices that nobody knew about until the GDR fell. And there was another 100 plus of those.
Wow.
And even in like tiny towns, they were all over the place, but these were the secret ones that you didn't know about.
You know, it makes me wonder, like, when the Chinese Communist Party falls, what's going to come out? How many informants were there? How many public security bureaus were there?
Well, I don't know if they'll, because one of the things about the Stasi is that they kept a lot of records. So that's one reason they know about a lot of this stuff now. I don't know how that works inside like the MSS, for example.
Well, like in China, when there's censorship directives, a lot of times there's certain instructions for the media, those are passed down orally, and people are instructed to not take notes on it. And that's
yeah, I mean, the reason we know so much about like the Stasi or even what happened in the Soviet Union is because of the records that were left behind. So maybe the Chinese Communist Party has realized that we should cover our tracks.
I mean, they've really learned a lot of lessons from the fall of the Soviet Union on like what not to do when oppressing people.
And yet the most important lesson, that communism doesn't work, was not learned.
Oh, I thought you were going to say that the lesson was don't oppress people.
No, that's not the lesson they took away from it.
Same thing.
Well, no, but it, you know, they learned that the communist collective economic model didn't work, and they fixed it to be a state-led, I guess, mercantilism or sort of state-led capitalism type model. So that's one thing they fixed. But they also learned, for example, they saw all the weaknesses with, like, oh, you know, the church was a resistance movement. Okay, now we have to make sure that you know, we're appointing all the church leaders, that, you know, we're making sure the Bible doesn't have certain subversive passages. We're making sure that, you know, the church itself has to be a essentially party organization. Make sure that foreign companies, they can come in, but they can't be completely independent. They've got to have, you know, our party members in it to monitor what they're doing. So they've learned all these things, and they're applying them now. So we're seeing a very clever, a very advanced version of all this.
I do have to say that another thing I think they learned very well was the influence of, like, a democratic Western culture, and how to, because I think that's what they're trying to do now with co-opting Hollywood, and to basically build up a nationalistic culture that people believe in more than they are tempted or influenced or, you know, corrupted or whatever you would say by this Western culture. And in the Stasi Museum, people, one of the things that if you had a, you know, poster of Bugs Bunny on your wall, mm-hmm. or something, that would count as you're being corrupted by Western influence. You know, if you owned Levi's, like these kinds of signals, right, that you are not ideologically pure and loyal to the GDR. That was really interesting to see. Also, you know, Bruce Springsteen played close to the Berlin Wall in the 80s. David Bowie played.
What about the most important musician of all?
I did go to the David Hasselhoff Museum.
There's Berlin. A whole museum?
Well, calling it a museum is a little...
There was a gift shop there, though, right?
No. It was actually...
There wasn't a gift shop?
It's because it's not really a museum. In the Circus Hostel, there is a corridor that's dedicated to David Hasselhoff. Mm. And it is a David Hasselhoff museum. But, you know, so it has, like, stuff from Baywatch, and it has his Knight Rider, and then it has a bunch of stuff from... that references what Matt is talking about, which is the fact that David Hasselhoff played a concert on the Berlin Wall in December of 1989, a month and a half after the Berlin Wall fell. And he, you know, wore this, like, light-up leather jacket and a piano scarf. And he had this song called Looking for Freedom, which is a translation of a German song, I think. That became a big hit in Germany.
Wait,
in the 80s and 90s.
Wait, he did his concert before or after the Berlin Wall fell?
After. It was after the Berlin Wall fell. It was December 31st, 1989.
Well, that's disappointing because I always thought that he...
Pulled down the wall.
Pulled down the wall through the strength of his voice and rugged
good
looks.
That is actually what it says in the David Hasselhoff Museum. I will post a photo on Twitter.
So you can follow Shelley Jung on Twitter at...
At S-H-E-L-Z-H-A-N-G. And I've posted some stuff from the Stasi Museum, but I'll post more. Like, they have, you know, exhibits like, here are the recording devices hidden in tree trunks. And here is a, you know, the paper shredder they used to try to shred all of the information. And the head of the Stasi was a weird guy. He...
You don't say.
Really, right? In the Stasi Museum, they have his office there like it used to be. And so he's got this big desk. It doesn't look fancy, by the way. It's not luxurious. But he has a big desk. And then in front of his desk are two chairs facing this little desk in the middle, so the chairs are facing sideways. So if you were to report to him, you'd have to sit sideways in this chair and turn your body to face him. Hmm. So it was kind of a power thing where he wanted you to, you know, be uncomfortable in his presence. And
as if you weren't uncomfortable enough already reporting to the head of the Stasi.
They had in the Stasi Museum the briefcase where he kept incriminating evidence about his own boss, the head of the GDR at the time. So,
so that's how he became head of the Stasi.
Well, I mean, if you don't have anything to blackmail your boss with, can you really have job security?
That's a good point.
One of the things that they talked about was the fact that he was never really... He died in prison, but he was never prosecuted for what he did as head of the Stasi.
So on what charges was he in prison?
He was imprisoned on charges of when he was a young revolutionary having murdered in like 1947 or something like that, having participated in the murder of, I do not remember who it was.
So it's kind of one of those things where, like, you know, they got Al Capone on tax evasion?
Something like that. I think also because... You know, when the GDR fell, there was a lot of kind of angst over what's going to happen, how are East and West Germany going to reunite, like all this stuff. And I think the Stasi Museum, they said that only a handful of people were ever charged for what they did with the actual Stasi. Like, the kind of exposure of this is still going on in some ways. Like, they're still finding out what happened and what people did. And like I said, you can go look at see your file, but do you want to know? Can you live with knowing who... I think that's another thing. Like, the paranoia of living in that kind of police state is something... Because I grew up in China, but I left when I was quite young. So I didn't really experience that. The guide I had at the Stasi Museum, he talked about his father-in-law had grown up in the GDR, and then he had gotten permission to leave East Berlin to fly out to West Germany to visit a relative, and then he did something he didn't have permission to, which was to fly back into West Berlin to visit other relatives. And then there was a building in West Berlin where you could kind of like go to the top and see East Berlin. And his father-in-law refused to, because he said, if I can see East Berlin, that means they can see me. And what if they find out that I'm here when I'm not supposed to be here? So like that kind of paranoia, you know, the Stasi can't watch everybody, but they want you to think that they can be watching you no matter what.
Well, it's the panopticon principle.
Yes.
Of that.
Oh, yes, the panopticon principle.
No, it's like, oh, come on, Chris. Didn't we talk about this? It's like the idea of a prison where you have like a guard tower in the center and all the cells around it, and so like the prisoners each know that their cell could be monitored at any time by the guards in the center. They don't know if they're currently being monitored, but they know that they could be, and so the fear is always there.
I don't know what kind of conversations you think you and I have, but it's not about prison guards.
At any rate, so but this is also how the Chinese police state works. I mean, when you're using WeChat, when you're kind of, you know, walking down the street in Shanghai and there's surveillance cameras, like, you just know that you could be being watched at any time. Whether or not they're paying attention to you as an individual is unknown, but the fear, this is the important part, you know, the fear is still there.
I wonder if people really think about that, though. I don't think most people would, but I think with the increase of the surveillance state, I think more people will be. I think, like, for example, on WeChat, now that people are seeing things on WeChat being censored, in private groups, or people have been arrested for what they said in private groups, people are understanding that you're not really able to speak freely there. But I think that wasn't always the case.
See, that's funny, because I actually am constantly thinking about, you know, am I being watched? Am I putting something on the public record that could be, you know, problematic? And like, I'm in a free country, but I'm just, all my China watching for the last 15 years.
I mean, I think he's become sensitized, right?
Has just made me very sensitive to it. And I'm not a paranoid person, but I am sensitive. And I do notice, for example, you know, when there's security cameras or when, or like, for example, when we text each other on SMS and like we make some jokes, whatever.
Oh,
sometimes we have to put like a disclaimer, you know.
Oh, well, I'm joking when I said if the FBI is watching this, we don't mean it, you know.
I know, because it would be the NSA,
right?
Not the FBI. That's the
why.
Joke.
Yes, yes.
Well, it's funny because like I also ask myself often, am I being watched? But it's a very different thing for me. Oh. I hope I'm being watched.
Yes, am I being watched enough? No, I need to be watched more. Mm. Yeah. What are those view counts? Well, I mean, I do have to say though, like, I've become now fascinated with the GDR and the Stasi, and
I have an idea for a spin-off show.
East Germany on
history.
On history.
Like, I mean, I don't know that people would really be that interested since it's
historical.
It's historical, but
we would eventually run out of things to talk about.
Yeah. But I think it is, if you do go to Berlin, and I would say the Stasi Museum is definitely, if you're interested in this stuff, and I imagine if you're listening to this podcast, you probably are, that the Stasi Museum is definitely somewhere you should go. And I would also say the DDR Museum, the Checkpoint Charlie Museum, kind of, but it's kind of like a museum that was put together by a crazy person. I mean, not... It's basically like an eccentric old guy started collecting things from like related to the Berlin Wall. And so you walk into this museum and there are just like these huge placards everywhere translated badly in several different languages, like all over the walls. And then there's some cool stuff. Like you can see some of the things people used to escape East Germany. Like they had, you know, these like rigged balloon things that people would make themselves
in the shape of Karl Marx.
No. Or they'd have, you know, the car that smuggled people out of
East, shaped like Karl Marx.
The Karl. See what you've done to
take
me.
Take a ride in my Karl.
That sounds so creepy somehow.
They did actually have an East German car. That was the car that everybody got. It was a Trabant that, you know, again, you know, socialist manufacturer, like obviously better than any West German cars, you know.
Yes, the Germans aren't known for their car design.
No. Well, I guess the East Germans weren't. So the Checkpoint Charlie Museum, it kind of, when you get up to the further floors, suddenly there's, you know, something on North Korea and Syria and Guernica, the Pablo Picasso. It gets weird is what I'm saying.
Okay.
So it's interesting to look at the stuff, but I wouldn't go there to learn about what happened in East Germany. And then you should also definitely go to see the Berlin Wall at Bernauer Strasse, which is not the East Side Gallery, which has, that's a section of the Berlin Wall where like everybody had done all the paintings and stuff and graffiti on it. But there's a section of the Berlin Wall at this place called Bernauer Strasse, and that actually shows you where people were trying to escape the wall. Like when the wall suddenly went up, there were still houses along the street. So people were literally jumping out the windows of these houses so they could get from East Berlin into West Berlin. And the West Berlin Fire Department would be like stationed under these windows 24/7 in the first few weeks to try to catch people.
Whoa.
And they would have little plaques along where you could see where, you know, they would mark where people managed to escape on one side of the wall and the people who attempted to and didn't make it on the other side. And you can see also that where the tunnels were that people built, like they dug in from West Berlin to try to reach people, because people had family and friends and you know, who were on the other side through an accident of geography.
I mean, it is crazy. They just basically split the city in half.
They split a country and then they split the city, right?
Yeah, and actually it's the weirdest part, and I didn't learn this until, you know, maybe 10 years ago, that actually Berlin, the entire city of Berlin is within East Germany.
Yes.
But then they split the city. So you have this half of Berlin is West Berlin that's sitting completely surrounded by East Germany.
Yeah, that's why the Berlin Wall bifurcated West Berlin, East Berlin. And then also there was a section of the wall that completely surrounded the rest of West Berlin. So, and you could see, you know, when they eventually built up the wall, there was that dead zone in the middle where they had, like, the guard towers and the anti, like, tank, like, things up that, and different, you know, I don't know if they used mines or whatever, but basically this no man's land that you'd have to cross. But in the beginning, when they first built the wall, they hadn't, like, demolished these houses and stuff yet, so people were trying to find ways to tunnel, they were trying to find ways to get across, and it's pretty amazing to see. And you can also see there's a Stasi tunnel. It's not there anymore, but you can see where it was and how the Stasi dug this tunnel to try to cut across as many possible tunnels as they could, to like try to find all these hidden tunnels that people had built. It's pretty, I mean, I found it very moving, and there's a U-Bahn station right by there that was a ghost station during the GDR, which was because they had built the train system before the country was split and the city was split. There were certain stations where, like, the train from West Berlin would pass through these stations that are technically in East Berlin. So on your way to work, you might pass through East Berlin and back out to West Berlin. And the East Berlin stations, they would station guards there so nobody could get on or off the trains.
Mm.
And so there are these, in this station, you can see the photos of the guards there. And then they were also afraid of the guards escaping, so they eventually built this little box for the guard to be in when he was on duty, so that, like,
so the guard couldn't escape.
Jeez. Because they also had, you have to have multiple guards so the guards could all watch each other, because there were incidents that happened where somebody escaped, a guard went after the guy, the guard didn't come back, a second guard went after the second guard didn't come back, you know, so they had some of those things happen. So then they decided to kind of put the guard in a box and lock him in.
Why would anyone want to leave this glorious German Democratic Republic?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a, you know, you don't know why. It's a mystery.
Yeah, just they're corrupted by Western values like Bugs Bunny.
That's clearly why. Bugs Bunny and Levi's jeans.
So what I'm getting from you, Shelley, is that real communism hasn't ever been tried.
Well, I think it definitely made me think about how innovative the Chinese Communist Party has become in certain ways. I mean, a lot of it is reminiscent, but also they've definitely, you know, the version 2.0 is
they brought communism into the 21st century.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. Yeah, I mean, I think if you're interested in this topic at all, the movie The Lives of Others is a good one to watch, especially if you're interested in the Stasi. It's a German language movie. German language movie that won the Oscar for Best Foreign Film a number of years ago, but it is about a Stasi officer and watching, you know, these suspect German intellectuals and what happens. And it's pretty fascinating because it shows a lot of the things that were in the Stasi Museum. Like, in the beginning, there's an interrogation, and the guy who's being interrogated is sitting on a chair and he's got to sit on his hands. And the reason is that they've put a cloth on the chair, and after the guy's taken out of the interrogation room, they take the cloth and put it in this glass jar to save his smell for the dogs.
Wow.
Yep. Yeah.
Although that's old technology, because now everyone's carrying smartphones with them so they can just be tracked through GPS.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say they have robot dogs.
They do have robot dogs. The Boston Dynamics dog that we saw that video.
Oh, that's
that
true.
That was creepy.
That was very creepy.
Speaking of creepy, if you were to design a car in the shape of Karl Marx's head, where are the doors?
Ears, obviously.
I guess so. Or like, what if you get in through the mouth?
No, I mean, what? Which way is he facing? Are you going?
Yeah, is his face facing up, or is it like forward? imagine that coming down the road at you.
I think it's a.
Send us your Karl Marx car designs.
It's a vertical car kind of thing, where it's pretty tall because it's in the shape of like a regular upright head.
Uh huh.
Uh huh.
Like yeah.
You know. It takes the free market to create Karl Marx's car.
But the problem is the beard would get super grungy, right?
Depends what it was made out of, maybe.
You could make it out of those steel bristles they use on the street sweepers. Then it would also clean the street as it's driving.
Yeah. It'll
make society better.
Yeah. Something you brought up that was interesting is how they were very concerned about the influence of Western ideology.
Or culture, right?
And culture, yeah. Which is something that, the Chinese Communist Party today is very concerned about, but they've done it in a very different way, where they've gotten to subvert these Western institutions to follow more of a party line. And recently there was a perfect example of that with CBS choosing to self-censor a show, The Good Fight, that was talking about censorship in China.
And we did an episode on this, which was published on Saturday on China Uncensored.
Yeah, that was pretty interesting because the creators of the show, the producers of the show, had wanted specifically to do this episode that was about kind of American companies being willing to compromise their ethics, basically, to get into the China market, where they used a Google analog called ChumHum. And it mentioned what happened with the Uyghurs. And that was pretty, like, it was all, like, ripped from the headline stuff.
And funny enough, life imitates art.
I think in a way that nobody really saw coming.
Yeah. And so joining us today, we actually have somebody who was involved in the CBS show that got censored. Jonathan Colton is an independent musician and songwriter. He's also the musical director for John Hodgman's Little Gray Book Lectures and the contributing troubadour for Popular Science magazine. And he has his own eponymous annual cruise. Jonathan also writes songs for animated shorts used in the CBS show The Good Fight, one of which was about censorship in China, and that was then censored by CBS. So, Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Yes, hello. Thank you for having me.
So, I understand that your fans call you Joko for short.
Yeah, that was... I think it was originally a tongue-in-cheek nickname, and it kind of stuck. I'm not sure to what extent it is ironic anymore.
Oh, that's a big-time celebrity nickname. How much more famous are you than J-Lo?
I would say I'm much less famous than J-Lo.
Well, I don't want to get your hopes up too high, but after this podcast, let's just say...
Well, I know. That's what they say. You go on the right podcasts, and that can change everything, so... Fingers crossed.
Yes, and this is, you know, we are one of the top ranked China podcasts in the world.
See?
So, yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
According to Time Out Magazine, which ranked...
Basically every China podcast. So, you know, when there's only like 10 China podcasts, it's easy to be in the top 10.
Yeah, sure. Well, that's a good trick. You swim in a small pool, and then you're a very big fish.
Oh, yes. We are big fishes in a small, small pond.
Amen.
Amen. All right, let's get on with it. So you wrote a song about Chinese censorship, and that was supposed to be used in, like, it's basically like a schoolhouse rock-style animated short in the CBS show The Good Fight, except CBS refused to air it. What was in the song?
Well, The idea for the song came from the writers and the showrunners, Robert and Michelle King, who are a married couple who created the show and run it and do some writing and directing and producing. and they so the they wanted to have a short animated short that talked about how one of their prior shows, which is called The Good Wife, is actually banned in China. You can't see it anywhere in China. And they believe it's because there was an episode of that series where a character was a Chinese dissident who had gotten arrested and imprisoned for years and tortured in prison and all this stuff. And they believe that's one reason why the Chinese government banned their series. So they wanted to talk about that, and they wanted to talk about this phenomenon that happens in entertainment, but also in the tech world, where corporations who are hoping to do business in China to either sell their movie to that market or their television show to that market, or to have a software or a website that is available to people in China, that frequently U.S. companies will choose to change their content or the way their software works in order to keep the censors in China happy, so that they are not banned in China, so that they have access to that market and can sell their stuff there. So that was the basic idea that they gave me for the song, and their writers, I did one of these for each episode, and so their writers would always give me a little briefing on the subject, and then I sort of had free rein to structure the song how I wanted, but that was the basic idea.
Did you have any sense that you were heading into very ironic territory?
No, I didn't. You know, one thing I love about the Kings is that they are pretty punk about these sorts of things, which is to say that they don't really shy from conflict, and they don't really like to compromise. You know, they have things that they want to say, and they want to say them. So, and you know, I know that at the same time they are very careful as they're doing these things that they know are sometimes going to be edgy. The show is pretty political. It takes place in the present day, in the present Trumpian situation that we're all living in, and it's a lot about that. So I know they're very careful about making sure they're not running into any situation where the network would not be able to air something that they're doing. So they have everything checked along the way, and they got approval for the lyrics of the song. Once I had sent them a rough draft, they got approval for the storyboard of the animation. And then CBS made the decision at the very last minute to not include the cartoon in the show. So yeah, I didn't expect this was going to happen. My hope was that we were going to get it in the show, and then it was going to get banned in China. That was my hope, because the name
you
of the song,
great dreams.
Start small. The name of the song is Banned in China. And at the end of the song, I say, you know what? I hope this song is banned in China. But of course, now it'll never have a chance
to be banned in China.
That's right, because it was censored in the United States.
Which is what's terrifying about this.
Yeah, it is a strange thing, you know, and it's I had heard about this before, mainly through the tech world, you know, the idea that Google would censor its search results in order to fall in line with the kind of internet that the Chinese government wants to exist. And
well, I understand that on this particular episode of The Good Fight, they were kind of doing a parody of Google with a company called Chum Hum, which makes me think of sharks. But
totally, yeah.
It was about that very same thing, that they were going to create.
It was not a very veiled, the Chum Hum was creating a secret search engine called Praying Mantis.
And what did they say? They didn't say censored. They said it was, do you remember?
It was customized.
Customized, that's it.
Customized, yes indeed.
So you should have just customized your song for the American market.
Well, I guess we thought it was customized for the American market.
Well, this was pretty. I think probably the things that CBS objected to, you know, preemptively on behalf of China, were pretty baked into the song. I'm not sure you could really, you know, if you cut out all the parts that would have been trouble, you wouldn't end up with much of a song.
What was, in your view, the most problematic part of the song from what you think CBS's perspective might have been?
Well, you know, I don't really know for sure, of course, but I suspect that, in the bridge of the song, I actually went through and described a bunch of things that you can't say or show, a bunch of things that we know are censored in China. Talking about Falun Gong, talking about Tiananmen Square, the letter N, I believe, for a while was a banned.
Oh yeah,
image the an empty chair, and of course
for Liu Xiaobo,
Winnie the Pooh.
Yes,
good old Pooh.
And it's such a without knowing the context of it, the list is nuts. It's ridiculous. Winnie the Pooh. What harm could Winnie the Pooh cause?
Oh, you have no idea. Actually, we did an episode of China Uncensored about that, and we figured since you have also made a song about Pepe the Frog, the joke was we had created this terrifying mashup of Winnie the Pooh and Pepe the Frog. It's a wonderful thing to have on the internet now.
Yeah. It's a very upsetting idea.
Yes. We called it Pepe the Pooh, and it looks about as disturbing as you would imagine. Yeah.
The name alone.
Yeah. Well, speaking of things being on the internet, we were very sad to find that we couldn't find this animated short anywhere on the internet. And we all said, boy, it would really be a shame if somehow that got leaked onto the internet. Don't you agree? It'd be a shame if that got leaked on the internet.
I do. Joko. I do agree with you. I will say that the standards and practices people at CBS called me after this decision was made to explain why they made this decision, and I did promise that I would not let this video out onto the internet. So. Unfortunately, if it does get leaked, it will not be me who does it.
But are you forbidden from, say, I don't know, singing us a line of the bridge of that song?
I don't know if I'm probably not forbidden. I will tell you that one of my favorite lines, and of the 10 songs that I did for the show, this is one of my favorites. It really turned out great. It's pretty... it says something that I really wanted to say. It's pretty, I think it's pretty sharp satire, if I do say so myself. But I will say one of my favorite lines is in the bridge where I say, it's just what I think is a very clever internal rhyme where I say, don't mention the letter N or Tiananmen Square, which is as a songwriter, that particular series of syllables pleases me greatly. The letter N or Tiananmen Square. I like that.
I mean, that's like Eminem level of rhyming. That's pretty good.
Yeah, see? It's the kind of quality you get when you hire Colton. Eminem level quality.
Well, I think we just gave you a new tagline.
I mean, he did he win an Oscar? Like, I feel... or
an Oscar? Like, or an Emmy? I think Eminem is known as a good... wordsmith, right? I'm not making that up, am I?
He's
out of
great.
Touch.
I think he's one of the best.
No, he's great.
Yeah.
Okay. I saw him rhyme orange once.
What did he rhyme it with?
Door hinge.
Yeah, he did a. Mm-hmm. He was on CBS. And
it was a
60 Minutes thing.
Was it censored?
No, it wasn't censored.
Just because it's on CBS.
You can talk about pretty much anything except China stuff and not be censored. No, he rhymed... something about the host asked him, can you rhyme with orange? And he's like, yeah, I can rhyme with orange. You just got to change the rhyme. And he meant slant rhyme, but he's just like...
it was like a four-inch door
hinge. Four-inch door hinge was
the
rhyme. Yeah, I mean, it was very clever. He's just right on the spot like that.
Yeah, that works.
But I imagine that your entire song about China and censorship was like that.
Letter N, Tiananmen. I'm really impressed with that. I think about that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Are you ever allowed to release the song?
Yeah, there is a clause in my contract that allows me to release all of these songs as an album at some future date. I would have to have somebody. I would have to have a lawyer review exactly what the terms are of that.
That might be wise.
Yeah, but I believe when the series is over, I'm allowed to release these songs as an album.
Okay. Well, so I got to know, when you got the word that, you know, CBS was going to censor this, did that perhaps pluck on your troll heartstrings at all?
Yeah, it did. I mean, I think honestly, the first emotion I felt was a kind of excited elation because I've never been censored by CBS before.
I can't say I've had that experience.
And it feels like an achievement. It feels like something that was on my bucket list that I didn't know was on my bucket list. So that was the first thing was like, wow. we really did something there.
You hit the right buttons.
Yeah, it was kind of an exciting feeling. But then, you know, under that was disappointment because I really was proud of this in the you know, the company that does the animation is this Canadian company called Headgear, and they are terrific. It's been a really good match between my songs and their animations. They amplify my jokes and they find their own jokes to sneak in there, and it's they're very clever and funny. I really love how they turn out. And this one was just such a, I don't know. I feel like it had an important message that it said very clearly and in a funny, interesting way. It was a catchy tune, all that stuff. The animation was great. So I was sad that it was not going to be in the show because I was proud of it. And then of course, you know, the ultimate thing is that it is so incredibly ironic that a song about US companies changing their content so as to not be censored in China would get censored in the United States. And in fairness, when CBS called me, they said, "We are aware of the irony." So I'm
okay. Oh, good.
I'm glad
of that.
But
it didn't stop them. It didn't stop them.
No, I mean, sometimes you have to do a thing that's ironic.
I guess so. Yeah,
I mean, did they express the specific reason for their concern? Like, was it afraid of advertisers pulling out or afraid of losing their network? Their streaming deal in China or anything specific?
The way they put it to me was that they had CBS has executives on the ground in China, and they were worried that those people would fear for their safety. That's how they put it to me. And they were afraid. They were also worried about some sort of I guess they were worried about those people's phones getting hacked or maybe CBS getting hacked. You know, they weren't all that specific, but they did frame it as a sort of safety issue primarily.
They didn't mention the big streaming deal they recently signed in China?
Not to me, no.
I mean, there's an easy way to protect your staff from getting, you know, harassed in China, which is to not have staff in China.
Sure.
It is an option.
Oh, but there's
so much money to make in China. I understand that. No, it's
so Joko, I'm curious. Did you know about China and like the sort of censorship issues and human rights issues that were going on there before this song?
Yeah, I was aware of it. You know, I hadn't read too much about it, but occasionally something would get pinged on my radar, you know, and it was mostly in the tech world, mostly thinking about search. And I guess also thinking about Twitter, you know, those are the places where I think, human rights intersects with tech anyway. And, you know, the way these tools can really be, supportive of a more democratic way of thinking and how that collides with an authoritarian state who wants to control you know, the truth, and control what people say and who they say it to. You know, I think about that a lot. I was originally a software developer before I became a professional musician, so you know, I think about tech a lot, and those subjects have always been interesting to me because I think, I don't know, it is a real collision of ideas that I'm not sure how it's going to be resolved. And you know, I'd been aware of it in the entertainment business, but I'd never seen an example up close. And of course, since this happened, and I've been reading articles about it, I've learned about more things that have been happening all along. You know, Hollywood has already been changing things in the United States to please the Chinese government.
And we've certainly covered on our show recently, it's come out that like Microsoft and Google, they've been doing research with Chinese military universities, and some of the fruits of that research is going to, for instance, surveilling the Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang.
Right.
So it's definitely sad to see how sort of the whole Silicon Valley, the whole tech world, like it was supposed to be such a good thing. Like the internet was supposed to be this thing that would connect us and kind of make the world, as you said, like a more democratic place. And in reality, gosh,
it does
a lot
connect
of money.
People, but it also connects people to the Chinese government
and then the Chinese police, which is a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's very easy for me to say like, yeah, I hope this song does get banned in China, you know, but I do recognize that it is a complicated issue. And, you know, you think about the idea that and I honestly can't remember if it was somebody, a spokesman at Google who said this in the past or a fake spokesman for the fake company ChumHum who said this on the show. That's part of the problem with media today. But I think that I can kind of understand this idea that in some ways you would almost rather have I'm going to pose it as a question. Would you rather have a little bit of Google in China, even if it's a compromised Google, or would you rather have no Google in China? What is the best thing for human rights in the long term? And I don't know. I don't know the answer. And this is not to defend any particular specific choice that any particular corporation has made, but just that I do recognize that it's not always easy, especially for a large corporation, to say, oh, this is the best thing for humanity, and so we will do that regardless of all these other concerns.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true, but I also think it's a dodge in a lot of ways. And this happened both, I think, with Google and a lot of these Yahoo, a lot of these internet companies, and with ChumHum and The Good Fight, where they were like, well, we're just following the relevant law. Like, we're following the law. We have mm-hmm. to follow the law in whatever country we operate in. And then it's kind of like, okay, so just because something is legal doesn't mean it's moral, but mm-hmm. they can kind of use that as like a shield that, like, we're just following the law. It's not up to us.
Were you involved at all in the sort of compromise that the Kings came to with CBS about how to handle?
No, I was not. That happened without my participation. I had handed the song in. It was approved. They were working on the final mix. And then I got a call from the Kings after that compromise had been reached. And that's the first time I heard that it was going to be censored from the show. The way it was explained to me is that CBS said, you know, we can't put this cartoon in the show, and that the King's first reaction was that they threatened to stop working on the show. And were understandably upset for this last minute excision. And they reached this compromise where CBS agreed that they would take the cartoon out, but they couldn't just seamlessly take it out. The King said, we want you to be on the record for censoring this. So you have to put up a screen that says this content has been censored by CBS. And I think initially they wanted it to last the whole 90 seconds length of the cartoon,
wow.
which is hilarious. A hilarious idea that you'd be watching a streaming show and then suddenly there would be 90 seconds of this,
That would make it seem more real, I think, that if it lasted that long.
Yeah, but I think in once they started to actually think about doing that, they said, well, that maybe is a little too peevish. And you know, they do care about their fans and people liking the show and being able to watch the show. So, you know, I think they ultimately cut it down to about 8 seconds, which is still weirdly long. But I think that... an unanticipated consequence of that is that a lot of people saw that episode and thought that it was a joke.
I heard that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, some people, because when we did a China Uncensored episode about this, some people in the comments were like, I saw that and I thought it was, they were kidding. Like, they thought it was like an ironic commentary on censorship.
Yeah, it is definitely an ironic commentary on censorship, but it is not a joke.
Well, but I think it's great that the Kings push this level of compromise, even though they couldn't show it, just because it did start the conversation. And now, at least, we're talking about what did get censored, and there's some more awareness about all those things.
Yeah, I agree. And I think one of the, you know, as you say, it's important to have a conversation about these things. And I think it's more, even more important to know that it's happening. And I think, you know, the fact that U.S. entertainment companies can change things in their script and in their edits, and that we would never know what is motivating them to do that, I think is a problem. I think it's important when this happens for people to be aware of it, because otherwise nobody's really held accountable for the decisions that they're making, and nobody's really held accountable for whether or not they are making moral decisions. And I don't always know the answer, but I think it's most important to have this conversation. And I will also say that in this episode, you know, the Kings also had a character who's a Uyghur who testified on the stand about the re-education camps and that stayed in the show. And I think that's a good thing. I mean, it may end up that the show is banned in China anyway for that. But, you know, it's another important conversation to keep having, especially in light of censorship issues, because if you are playing ball, these are the people that you're playing ball with, and these are the things that they're doing.
It is interesting. That's how I first heard about this episode of The Good Fight, was people talking on Twitter about the fact that a network show talked about the Uyghurs.
Mm-hmm. When a fictional drama brings up this, you know, Uyghur human rights abuse, it actually makes it more real in a way.
Yeah, or that, like they said, like basically this probably did more to educate people in the U.S. about what was happening to the Uyghurs in China than like 100 news articles.
Yeah, and I think it's for one thing because people don't read. They certainly, you know, a lot of people don't read about things that are happening in other countries. So then, yeah, you put it in a fiction show that people watch, and it gets people's attention. But then also it kind of bounces around. It becomes, you know, the fact that appeared in the show becomes a code hook that journalists can hang their articles on and then write an article and say, well, you saw this on The Good Fight. Here's the thing that they're talking about, you know. So it creates that churn that I think is important for hearing about that stuff.
Well, that's certainly what we did with this.
Yeah, exactly.
So moving forward, has this changed anything for you?
No, not really. I mean, I think
come on, this is your moment for deep insight, for something profound.
Well, I mean, the thing that had changed in my thinking is that my gosh, this happens all the time. This is happening all the time everywhere, and we don't even know that it's happening. And I guess that is an aspect of this that I didn't really understand, or I hadn't really internalized until it happened right in front of me to something that I made. And you know, I've become a little more aware of it, and I've become, I think, a little more understanding of how insidious a problem it is when it is not talked about and nobody's held accountable for it. So that's I think one change in my thinking. And you know, I don't know. I think that, you know, the show has been picked up for a season 4, and I believe the Kings are interested in doing more of these songs and videos. And you know, like Google, I think it's probably, I feel like it's better for us to keep knocking on this particular door, and then to you know, I would never tell CBS that I'm not going to work with them or something like that, because they made this decision. Because I do think that it's still, you know, we're still sneaking some important messages through, and I think that's good.
Well, in some ways, I'm sorry to hear about season 4, because I want your album to come out.
I know. Well, the problem is, you know, I don't get too excited. It's not. I mean, all this hype about this song, it's just another 90-second song.
You rhymed the letter N with Tiananmen.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's not going to, you know, this is what's going to happen. It's a couple of years from now, I'm going to release this album. People are going to be like, oh, boy. Here's the China song, and they're going to listen to it and be like, oh, that wasn't very good.
Don't worry. In a couple of years, people will have forgotten about it.
Fingers crossed.
Have you thought about writing a song called Banned by CBS, which is just the Banned in China song, but just with a new title?
I have not thought about that. You know, listen, I'm almost 50. I got too many other important things to say. I feel like this issue has pretty much spoken for itself.
Well, if you do decide to write that Banned by CBS song, please share the royalties with us.
Absolutely. The idea came from here.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Joko, I'm calling you that because I'm now a fan and eagerly looking forward to the China song on your album in 2025.
Exactly.
After another long run for a good fight.
That's right. And thanks so much for having me on, guys. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Take care.
All right.
So I'm just curious. This is not in the podcast, but I'm just wondering.
Don't believe her.
CBS. I'm just wondering if CBS has been okay with you talking about this, because I saw an article from CBC, for the Canadian broadcaster, where they interviewed Steve Angel from Headgear, and the reporter mentioned that there was a CBS publicist on the phone when he was talking to him.
No, they are not. They were not particularly happy about this, and you know, the reason it came up is because Emily Nussbaum, who wrote about it first, she's a TV critic for The New Yorker. She is a friend of mine. I've known her for many years. Our kids go to the same elementary school. And she's a huge fan of the show and of the Kings and all of her other shows. And so, she's been interested to watch these videos and, hear these songs. And so she knew this one was coming. And then I had dinner with her, right after I had learned that it was, censored. And so I told her about it, and she was like, I think this is a really important and interesting article. Will you do an interview with me? And I said, yes. So it did not go through the official PR channels, and I'm sure they would have tried to dissuade me from talking about so many specifics if it had gone through those channels.
Yeah, she encouraged you to be on our podcast.
What's that?
You mean she encouraged you to be on our podcast?
No. She encouraged her.
You mean the New Yorker?
Yes, she writes for the New Yorker. So,
right. No, that's why I was confused for a second. I was like, she couldn't have possibly mentioned
her. We are not the center of the universe. No.
Matthew, come on.
But hey, actually, that was super interesting. Is that something we can put back into the podcast?
Yeah, sure. You can put that in there.
All right. Well, I told you not to believe Shelley.
Okay, yeah, I know. Yes, it's my fault.
Yes. Cool. Well, I'm glad we got that little last extra bit. And really, now, finally, thank you for joining us. It's been great having you on the podcast.
Well, I appreciate it, guys. Thanks. Good luck.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Bye. All right. And now, this isn't going to be on the podcast, but let me let me ask you about something controversial.
All right. Thanks, guys. Talk to you later.
Thanks.
Take
Bye.
Care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to China Unscripted. Once again, I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Ganesda.
And leave us a review on iTunes. Goodbye.